we might as well get started. The feast is a powerful symbol for Dickens, and I would like to talk about the feast today and tomorrow, talk about hunger a little bit, and about Dickens' own life and the kind of imagination out of which these feasts arose, for which he's so famous. And then also tomorrow I'm going to talk about Great Expectations and give you an opportunity to kind of dig into that if you like. But these things can, you can go to one or the other or none or whatever you like. They're not necessarily all connected. As I was saying, the feast is a powerful symbol for Dickens, and many of us are familiar with the Christmas Carol feast, you know, the great, wonderful Christmas feast of the Cratchit family with Tiny Tim and all that. In this Christmas book of Dickens, the feast is all the more glorious for reconciliation with Scrooge, that penny-pinching employer of Bob Cratchit. Here, near the beginning of the story, Scrooge is sitting by the fire with his bowl of gruel, thin gruel. It's right here. And the book calls him that squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. He is astonished when the ghost of Christmas Present enters the room and shows him what his Christmas might be like. It was his own room, there was no doubt about that, but it had undergone a surprising transformation. This is the ghost of Christmas Present. The walls and ceiling were so hung with living green that it looked a perfect grove, from every part of which bright gleaming berries glistened. Heaped upon the floor, to form a kind of throne, were turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, great joints of meat, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense Twelfth Night cakes, and seething bowls of punch that made the chamber dim with their delicious steam. This is the genial ghost. When this ghost transports Scrooge to the Cratchit home, he finds a dinner that's much less lavish because they're poor. But the riches that they share is the love and the companionship that goes along with their Christmas goose and their triumphant blazing pudding. Well, these feasts express a number of values I'd like to talk about today, values which Dickens wished would animate his whole society. And I think that in their broadest significance, the feasts are kind of an image, as Dickens' own art is an image, of the recreation of humankind. Food like sex is absolutely necessary for physical survival. This rather obvious fact was not so obvious to some people of Dickens' day, and those were always the people who ran the workhouses and the orphanages. This is from Oliver Twist. It's a rather famous etching called Oliver Twist Asks for More. I'll read you a little bit from that novel. Where he was staying, he had no parents. He was given three meals of thin gruel a day with an onion twice a week and half a roll on Sundays. That was his diet. The room in which the boys were fed was a large stone hall with a copper at one end, out of which the master, dressed in an apron for the purpose, and assisted by one or two others, ladled the gruel at mealtime. Each boy had one porringer and no more, except on great occasions of public rejoicing, when he had 2 ounces and a quarter of bread besides. The bowls never wanted washing. The boys polished them with their spoons till they shone again, and then they would sit sucking their fingers to get off every little stray bit of gruel that they could. Oliver Twist and his companion suffered the tortures of slow starvation for 3 months. At last they got so voracious and wild with hunger that one boy, who was tall for his age, hinted darkly to his companions that unless he had another basin of gruel per day, he was afraid he might some night happen to eat the boy who slept next to him, who happened to be a weakly youth of tender age. He had a wild, hungry eye, and they all believed him. council was held, lots were cast, who should walk up to the master that evening and ask for more, and the lot fell to Oliver Twist. The evening arrived, the boys took their places, the master in his cook's uniform stationed himself at the copper. His proper assistants ranged themselves behind him, the gruel was served out, and a long grace was said over the short common. The gruel disappeared, the boys whispered to each other and winked at Oliver while his neighbors nudged him. Child as he was desperate with hunger and reckless with misery. He rose from the table and advancing to the master, basin and spoon in hand, he said, somewhat alarmed at his own temerity, please, sir, I want some more. The master was a fat, healthy man, but he turned very pale. He gazed in stupefied astonishment on the small rebel for some seconds, and then he clung to the copper for support. The assistants were paralyzed with wonder, the boys with fear. What? The master said at length in a faint voice. Please, sir, replied Oliver, I want some more. The master aimed a blow at Oliver's head with a ladle, pinioned him in his arms, and shrieked aloud for the beadle. The parish board, who runs this workhouse, were sitting in solemn conclave when Mr. Bumble rushed into the room in great excitement and said, Mr. Limpkins, I beg your pardon, sir. Oliver Twist has asked for more. There was a general start. Horror was depicted on every countenance. And Mr. Limpkins replied, that boy will be hung. I know someday that boy will be hung. Treated as a criminal just because he wants some more. Besides survival, the spreading of the board is an opportunity to delight in all the senses, to take in natural goodness with the eyes and taste buds and nose and even the ears. This description is from a middle novel whose name is Little Dorrit. Most people have not heard of it, but it's a very good novel. And in this novel, there are three paupers walking along the street, coming to a dirty shop window in a dirty street, which was made almost opaque by the steam. But glimpses were to be caught of a roast leg of pork bursting into tears of sage and onion in a metal reservoir full of gravy, an unctuous piece of roast beef and blisterous Yorkshire pudding, bubbling hot, a stuffed fillet of veal in rapid cut, a ham in a perspiration with the pace it was going at, a shallow tank of potatoes glued together by their own richness, a truss or two of boiled greens and other substantial delicacies. Fanny, opening her purse as they surveyed these things, produced a shilling and handed it to Uncle. Uncle, after not looking at it for a little while, divined its object and muttering, dinner? Huh? Oh, yes, yes, yes. And he slowly vanished from them into the mist. Probably a shilling would not have bought very much in that shop. But this worn-out old man, who is dead to the world of the senses, is dangerously close to entering the next world. Very often, poverty, even if you do have a little money, will take away your appetite. In this picture, these are two men in a debtor's prison, and the debtor's prison has taken away their appetite. Often, even Dickens' high society people can't appreciate the sensory richness of their own feasts. For instance, again in Little Dorrit, there is a dinner for high society people. It says, society had everything it could want and could not want for dinner. It had everything to look at, everything to eat, and everything to drink. It is to be hoped it enjoyed itself. But Mr. Myrtle, who is the host at this dinner, his own share of the repast might have been paid for with 18 pence. He sits in the corner and drinks tea because he has a bad digestion. For Dickens, it's very important that a person be able to relish a feast, because to relish the feast is to be somebody, and he uses that word, to be somebody. To be very particularly alive, as though the succulent substantiality of the feast kind of calls forth your own aliveness. Dickens' corollary to this is that to appreciate art is also to be somebody, to be human. And to be dead to the powers of art is to be nobody in his novels. We all know that Scrooge was insensitive to Christmas, but he's also insensitive to art. He comes home after work all grumpy and chilly, and he's standing by his door that he's just closed. And then the owner of one scant young nose, gnawed by the cold as bones are gnawed by dogs, stooped down at Scrooge's keyhole to regale him with a Christmas carol. But at the first sound of, "God bless you, merry gentlemen, may nothing you dismay," Scrooge seized the ruler with such energy of action, and the singer fled in terror, leaving the keyhole to fog and to the frost. So in a way, Scrooge is insensitive to art, to the popular art of the Christmas carols. There are a number of links between feasts in Dickens and art, and I'll mention them as I come to them along here. Dickens was appalled, by the way, at what passed for painting and art in his own day. He liked the popular arts, but some of the high-class art was really pretty bad. For instance, some of the passionless conventional portraits of Victorians that you've seen. And he linked it with the failure, very, very many failures of his society to celebrate the senses. Instead, the senses were repressed. There's a character in this same novel, Little Dorrit, whose name is Mrs. Clennam, who's a very religious old puritanical woman. And she is, she calls artists children of evil, and calls the arts the accursed snares for the flesh. It's a religious argument in part, but also maybe kind of a psychological problem too. And her idea of art were some great big glazed paintings on her parlor wall, pictures of plagues of Egypt. That was her idea of art. The feast does one of the things that art does in that it intensifies and concentrates sensations, as though the whole substantiality of creation were presented. In Little Dorrit, people who are let out of prison experience a rush of physical sensations. Prison cuts them off from the outside world, and they come out of it, and they suddenly experience their own aliveness. Dickens often mentions the Marshalsea Debtors' Prison in his novels, and other prisons too. Sometimes the prison is more psychological, kind of entrapment, or lack of feeling. Anyway, in this novel, the liberated people experience, very often will have a feast to kind of celebrate their coming out of prison. And thus there is a connection between the feast and the experience of freedom. This description is again from Little Dorrit. These people have just been let out of confinement. There, a great table in a great room was soon profusely covered with superb repast, dainty dishes, southern fruits, cooled wines, flowers from Genoa, snow from the mountaintops, and all the colors of the rainbow flashing in the mirrors. So if Scrooge moves from gruel through ghosts to goose, these people move from prison to a kind of prism. And the feast has a prismatic quality about it, with all the tastes and smells and sensations glittering before you as in the same way that the colors glitter from a prism. In the same novel, there is a swarthy, lovable convict. I wish I had a picture of him, but there wasn't one, who is in a French jail. And he finds a way, his name is Jean-Baptiste, by the way, he finds a way to have a meal of dry bread in that wasteland of a prison that is really a feast for his spirit, because he can sauce it with imagination. His partner asks, "How sauce?" And he holds up his knife and he says, "I can cut my bread so, like a melon, or so, like an omelet, or so, like fried fish, or so, like lion sausage." And he has a sort of personal liberation in the exercise of his own imagination with food. Along with physical renewal, the feast stimulates the feelings and allows for a kind of emotional release. Our senses, the evidence of our senses, provides kind of a basic vision of the world, whether that's affirmative or negative. And so the feast, which is very positive, not like this one or the Oliver Twist's feast, but perhaps more like Scrooge's feast in his room, the feast that has a lot of opportunity for us to relish pleasant sensations kind of creates a feeling of affirmation in the world. And so our Christmas feasts kind of partake of that, give us a feeling of God's limitless providence and his love. There's a retarded child in one of Dickens' stories who is speaking of a place which was more hospitably than her own home. She says, "Such lemonades, such oranges, such delicious broth and wine, such chicken. Oh, ain't it a delightful place to go and stop at?" And this is a hospital where she had gone, and after she had left there, she was never any older than 10 years old. But she had been beaten, and she had been starved, and so for her, this hospital was absolutely heaven. And she applies this same vision of affirmation from the feast in the hospital to a theater where she goes for a rare treat. She doesn't get very much entertainment, but she goes to the theater with a friend and she says, "Oh, ain't it a heavenly place? Almost as good as a hospital, only there ain't no chicken in it." But the place of popular art and the place of healing are both feasts for her spirit. Undeniably, there's an aspect of self-gratification in all our feasting. Can you see that? Those are dwarves living it up in the novel Old Curiosity Shop. But the feast requires a gathering of selves, and so the pleasure of the feast comes at least as much from the delighting of your senses and gratifying of your appetite in company with other delighters. There are guests, and there are hosts. And in some feasts in Dickens, like this one from David Copperfield at the Peggotty's, can provide a sort of microcosmic ideal society where the individuals and the group's interests enhance each other. There's even a rounded effect in the picture as though it's a self-contained world. And if you can see, Mr. Peggotty is standing in the middle pouring out some boiling hot water, perhaps for tea or for punch. And they're feeling very cozy. This idea of bringing the selves together to delight together is also typical of Dickens' own art. You know, he wrote his novels so that they came out in installments, in monthly or weekly installments. And it's hard to imagine today what kind of popularity he had. It was just phenomenal. Like when the boats would pull up at the American docks with new installments of his novels, hundreds of people would be there, and they'd be climbing over each other and poking each other in the eye with their elbows, and they'd be shouting to the hands on deck, "Is Nell dead yet? Have they caught him yet?" It's just incredible. And Dickens had a very special feeling for his audience. In one of his novels, Old Curiosity Shop, in the preface, and often he addresses his dear reader in the preface, and he really meant it. He quotes a preface from Tom Jones where there's a comparison made between the artist and his novel with the host and the feast. And he says that the author is the host not of an exclusive feast, but of a public banquet where people can come to regale themselves according to their tastes. And in his preface, Dickens even bids them a good old civic ceremony, which is a toast, and bids them hearty welcome, drinking to his guests a loving cup, to give you an idea of his feeling for his audience. So if there was a lot of self-indulgence in Dickens' novels, and I think in some ways that's true, there was also the opportunity to share these feasts of imagination that he had with other people. And of course, Dickens' dinners are normal domestic occasions within the plots of his novels. And on these occasions, families are bound together, hearth values are celebrated, and very often women are idolized. It might be easy to criticize some of this domestic sanctity that kind of hovers over some of his domestic interiors like this one. But it's important to remember that in Victorian world, things were changing very rapidly, and many old orders were being destroyed, and many old kinds of magic were being discredited, that the home provided a kind of magic circle. There again, the rounded effect, as though it were a magic circle that were a kind of protected place from the rest of the world, even a place protected against death, in some of the symbolism of the novels. If you remember David Copperfield, boy, it's hard to see these, isn't it? David Copperfield, one of his big disappointments with his child wife, Dora, is that she was a terrible housekeeper. And he's attempting to carve this underdone lamb with a friend of his he's had over for dinner, and the friend can hardly move for all the junk around him in the close apartment. He can hardly move his elbows. And Dora just sort of sitting dreamily at one end of the table. It's very disappointing to David Copperfield that his wife wasn't a better housekeeper. And there is a tremendous emotional need for that in that time. Although, you know, you can be forewarned that if you don't keep your house well, like Dora, you will die. But she did have to die in the novel eventually. She was replaced. The meal is kind of a focal point for the restoration of harmony in a small society, if not in the larger one. Dickens himself had a very tempestuous domestic life. And he loved his children, he had a lot of them, but his wife and he were not at all suited for each other. And eventually they were separated, so he did not have a happy domestic life. In some ways, this represents that, and some of the happy feasts are kind of ideals of things that he wished he had. So the small societies might be groups like this. These are people around the fire. This is from Great Expectations at the public house. That kind of drinking and smoking and eating together and telling stories and so on. Or some of the small communities in Dickens' novels are very strange. I mean, they're not all these very conventional domestic groupings. This one, it's even harder to see, it's so small, but this is from Oliver Twist, and on the left is the leader of Fagin's gang of little ragamuffin thieves, and Oliver, alone in London, is taken in by these people. And they encourage him to steal handkerchiefs and whatnot, you know, but there is a kind of community there. And so in contrast to those cruel orphanage people that I read before, there's a feeling of welcome that he never had before. Fagin, the guy on the left there, says, "We're very glad to see you, Oliver, very. Dodger, take off those sausages and draw a tub near the fire for Oliver." There is a sense of community even there. The gathering of friends about the festal board is a kind of emotional refreshment because of the pleasure of the senses and the pleasure of the company. There's a character in Old Curiosity Shop whose name is Dick Swiveller. Dick Swiveller loves to make grand speeches, especially when he's drunk. But one of his main philosophy is that the fire of soul is kindled at the taper of conviviality. The spirit is expanded by means of rosy wine. And well, here you can see there are spirits and there is spirit. Thomas Carlyle, someone whom Dickens read and appreciated a lot, wrote about the connection between soul and stomach. I'd like to talk about that for a few minutes. That can mean a number of very different things. Quite a few of Dickens' hypocrites are characters whose hearts reside in their digestive organs. And one of them is seen disposing of an immense quantity of solid food with the benignity of a good soul who is feeding someone else. There's a character named Chadband in Little Dorrit, and there are a number of characters like him who are gluttonous moral hypocrites, whose swelled size is proportionate to the shrinkage of their souls. And they are equally voracious in their consumption of talk. Let me give you a sample of Casby, who is called a patriarch and looks like one, but he's really a landlord, an absentee landlord who screws his tenants, who are all very poor. The patriarchal state, always a state of calmness and composure, was so particularly serene that evening as to be provoking. Everybody else within the bills of mortality was hot, but the patriarch was perfectly cool. Everybody was thirsty, and the patriarch was drinking. There was a fragrance of limes or lemons about him, and he made a drink of golden sherry which shone in a large tumbler as if he were drinking the evening sunshine. This was bad, but not the worst. The worst was that with his big blue eyes and his polished head and his long white hair and his bottle green legs stretched out before him, he had a radiant appearance of having, in his extensive benevolence, made the drink for the human species, while he himself wanted nothing but his own milk of human kindness. And he's talking to the man who does the dirty work for him, and he says, "I mean, Mr. Panks, that you must be sharper with the people, sharper with the people, sharper with the people, sir. You don't squeeze them. You don't squeeze them. Your receipts are not up the mark. You are made to do your duty, but you don't do your duty. You are paid to squeeze, and you must squeeze to pay." Well, for some characters, the exaggerated importance of food is a sign of their own personal emptiness. And there are many spiritually starving people in Dickens' novels who fill up their lives with material things, banks, ball gowns, and so on, and food is one of them. And I was also, in thinking about this, reminded of a limerick, and I'm not sure exactly how it goes. It's a traditional one, but it's something like this. "Violante in the pantry, gnawing on a mutton bone, how she gnawed it, how she clawed it, when she felt herself alone." This type of empty eater, Dickens presents in a character whose name is Flora Finching. Can you pick her out? The one there on the right with the white dress. She's sitting at dinner there. Flora Finching takes in a great deal of sherry with sentiment. And she has had romantic disappointments in life, but she makes up for them by eating a great deal and talking even more. On one occasion, this is not the picture, but on one occasion she is making a great romantic disclosure to one of her good friends. And she's speaking of her late husband and of what happened after the honeymoon. Her late husband she calls Mr. F. His name is Finching. And she doesn't like that horrible, ugly, old, disagreeable name, she calls it. So she calls him Mr. F. He was a man not of poetry, but of prose. And for that reason, she didn't really like him very much. She says, "I will draw a veil over that dreamy life. Mr. F. was in good spirits. His appetite was good. He liked the cookery. He considered the wine weak, but palatable. And all was well. We returned to the immediate neighborhood of number 30 Little Gosling Street, London Docks, and settled down. Ere we had yet fully detected the housemaid in selling the feathers out of the spare bed, gout, flying upwards, soared with Mr. F. to another sphere." His relict, with a glance at his portrait, shook her head and wiped her eyes. As if you didn't get it, he died. "I revere the memory of Mr. F. as an estimable man and most indulgent husband, only necessary to mention asparagus and it appeared, or to hint at any delicate little thing to drink, and it came like magic in a pint bottle. It was not ecstasy, but it was comfort." So she uses food to compensate for her romantic disappointments. Someone like Northrop Frye would talk about the feast as a symbol of victory over fertility in the wasteland. Well, you know, that's true in a way. Dickens has a very powerful symbol for him is the wasteland of urban life, particularly of urban feeling. And there are universal connections between sex and eating, so that you sometimes think that the voracious appetites people have might be kind of a substitute for any kind of expression of sexual appetite. For instance, in the old curiosity shop, there's a highly charged sexual figure named Quilp, who quaffs a boiling drink at one time, just all in one gulp, and he smacks his lips. And he does the same thing. He smacks his lips at little Nell, who's this child figure, as though she were a dainty morsel. And then in Pickwick Papers, which has been known for, as kind of a very innocent child's novel, there's a fat boy there on the right, who in some ways resembles the feasting Pickwick himself, who is a very innocent sort of character. And the fat boy is having dinner with a female companion, and he drops his fork and knife to his knees, and he ogles her. And with the look of the cannibal in his eyes, he says, "I say, how nice you look." That kind of leering happens every now and then in his novels. But whatever the sexual overtones might be, you know, on particular occasions, the feast is an image of human potency. It can also be the opposite. It can be an image of the lack of human warmth. For instance, in Little Dorrit, at a highly genteel dinner table, there is a dignified old gentleman there who is called a noble refrigerator in a ponderous white cravat like a stiff snowdrift, who shaded the dinner, cooled the wines, chilled the gravy, and blighted the vegetables. So the dinner table itself becomes a wasteland. A child's christening party in Dombey and Son, an early novel, is a very chilly affair. If the dinner is set forth in a cold pomp of gold and silver, and looking more like a dead dinner lying in state than a social refreshment. So you can see that sometimes the physical settings are very far indeed from the spirit of the religious occasion, and the company around the feast can be very chilly. But we were kindling the fire of soul at the paper of conviviality. So a final general point. The feast is often a ritual, and within the large ritual are some smaller ones that kind of point the occasion, give dignity to the ceremony of the feast. And there are always formal exchanges and speeches and stories, like Micawber here and David Copperfield. They're all enjoying a wonderful evening together. Do you remember Micawber? He's a man who was always in debt. But he manages to rise above it all, kind of through the transcendent power of his own language. And then in Pickwick, the Pickwickians regale each other with these pompous orations after dinner. They enjoy it all very much. In this picture, William Dorrit, he's there on the left, not the one in the middle. William Dorrit is talking at a social banquet. Notice everyone is standing. He is astonishing the dinner guests at this genteel dinner by improving the occasion with a little homily. And the homily is one that he used to give to prisoners when he was poor and in prison before he got his inheritance. And his mind has slipped back to the old time, and he's begun to address them as the people in the Marshalsea. There are also toasts and songs that are rituals at the dinner. This is a wonderful picture. I wish you could see it better. This is Mrs. Gamp proposing a toast to her fellow midwife in their leisure hours. She's quite a character, too, one who likes to talk and eat. These toasts and rituals and so on sometimes can be rather thin disguises for some fairly undignified behavior. This is from Martin Chuzzlewit. They're having a drink there in the office. Don't they look formal, their top hats and all? This is another occasion for some ceremony. So with songs and stories, the delights of popular art join with the delights of the feast for Dickens in his ideal feast. These ceremonies are very important because they provide a kind of order within a very disordered society. This is a picture of Ludgate Hill. You can see how incredibly crowded it is. What a traffic jam there is there. This was a sketch made during the day by Gustave Doré. You can see the kind of society that people might have wanted to escape from. In another sense, art also provided a kind of order for people within that sort of society. And besides restoring a sort of holy space for people, the feasts also provide a kind of temporal order. They are celebrated year after year, like the Christmas feasts, and they are remembered, they are looked forward to. So they kind of establish the continuity of the past, present, and future. And so the rituals of the feast, like other kinds of rituals, reorder and establish a new kind of time, sometimes even lifting people out of time for a little while. And of course, if you remember in the Christmas Carol, time plays a very important part in the regeneration of Scrooge. The ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future come to him. They help him to see his own lifespan and to reorder his own time so that his priorities are different and his future becomes new. And when he is restored, he is brought back to a kind of youthful self, really. He goes back to a feast, a family feast he's been invited to for years that he never went to, feast of his nephew. And this recalls some of his old memories from the past. This is the Fezziwig ball. So that he becomes young again. And his own time is kind of renewed and purified. And the feast is an important part of that celebration. And he even seems to win a kind of immortality through his regeneration. There might be some things, I don't know how much Dickens people have read, there might be some things that you would like to talk about, maybe you'd like me to, maybe you'd like to come up closer and see these better too, I don't know. But are there some reactions or thoughts about feasts in general perhaps, or in other novels that you've read? The immense exposure that Victorian society had to him. And I think there are really two strands in Dickens, and this is kind of a commonplace of Dickens' criticism, but I think it's really true. There is a rebel in Dickens, somebody who even kind of identifies with criminals and outcasts, and there is also a very conventional bourgeois Dickens as well. And those come out in his novels in a lot of ways. He's really committed to freedom and life and a celebration of vitality and independence from the past and from tradition. At the same time, he wants to anchor himself in some familiar things and is a little bit afraid of revolution. You know, he's not a Marxist, although some critics have tried to make him out to be one. But he was criticized for his exposing of some vices that were already taken care of. You know, he would project his novels into the past, things like the debtor's prison. But I think that you have to understand those kinds of abuses symbolically. The prisons, his diatribes against governmental red tape that just caught people up and strangled them and tripped them up, and they would go into the governmental bureaucracy and disappear. You know, there's a symbolic sense in which that's still very true. It's not really even symbolic. So there are lots of ways in which the kinds of oppression that he was really could understand and speak out against and embody in his novels are still with us in our Western culture in a lot of ways.
I really like your emphasis on his celebration. I haven't really, thought about before, but I don't know how many of you have read Dickens lately, but I would certainly recommend that you keep, if you do reread it, if you never have read one, just because there are a lot of annual, there's a lot of instances of, and experiences of celebration in the novel that are really worth reading in a time when we seem to be very lacking in imagination and
Well, if one were to start rereading Dickens, what might be the first book to jump into?
Okay. Exactly. I have an answer to that question. I brought along some stuff from Great Expectations, which is a fairly short novel compared to some of his other ones. And I would encourage some of you here to dig into it a little bit this week. I'll be here until Saturday, and we'll do some sessions on it tomorrow. I have copied the first four chapters. You can kind of get into it. Very different feats in Great Expectations. There are disenchanted meals, penitential nourishment, cannibalism in this novel. Really interesting things, and things about freedom and imprisonment, the kinds of guests, the manners that are used, the way the hosts treat the guests, that are very significant in this novel. And I think it would be a lot of fun to dig into that a little bit, you know, while you're here.
One copy in the library?
There are none that I could find. I brought five. I brought them from two libraries in Chicago, and they look like rare editions, so I want them back.
I believe Great Expectations is going to be on special TV this fall, too.
Is that right? Oh, good.
Will it be a new one, or is it the same
one? One new one.
But I enjoyed the old one. I'll never forget the one where the wedding feast had been left on the table, the cobwebs and everything, and the mice and the rats running all over. I'll never forget that.
Yeah, the images just stick in your mind. There's a kind of mythic power about Dickens' images that transcends the social environment in which he wrote, even.
They really capture that. You moved, I thought, the way it started, too. You have the moors, and then that meekness, and then the little boy, and then all of a sudden, boom, comes that convict out.
Yeah.
You really knocked you off your seat. Janet, why don't you tell these folks about the cake that you made?
Well, I thought I'd tell them about that tomorrow.
Okay.
I'll make them wonder about that.
Okay.
But I brought along plot summaries of it so that if you just want to, you know, glance at that, come to the session, you'd have an idea of what happens in the novel. And then I have some copies I'd be glad to loan out, too.
Yeah. Just on the idea of peace, and I think quite a change and a trend in contemporary life, as our daughter was married 2 weeks ago, and part of the wedding ceremony was a wedding feast. This was, of course, a feast of their own choosing, of their own preparation, and it added an entire new dimension to the wedding ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
To have it followed by this sharing,
mm-hmm.
this really to be something more than a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Another, but a different question. I didn't hear where these illustrations come from. Are they from a specific edition, or are there a compilation that you have found?
Well, we just shot one roll of film. There are lots more. These illustrations were an integral part of Dickens' work when it first came out in those monthly and weekly installments. Of course, lots of illustrators since, you know, have done a lot of illustrations, but these are the original ones. They're by two people, Hablo Brown, whose nickname was Fizz, and the other guy, George Cruikshank, probably done a couple of these. The tinted ones are special, you know, for the Christmas issue. The other ones were not tinted, I don't think, in the original. But they were an integral part of his work, and if we examine them, you know, we could probably find some real interesting little emblematic details in the pictures that are somehow kind of symbolic of something in the works. They're very, very detailed, carefully done. Dickens would very often tell his illustrators what he wanted. And they would get just the right expressions. Often there are portraits hanging in the background that kind of mock the characters. Interesting just to look at in themselves. And I got these out of the Oxford Illustrated, the Nonesuch Dickens. That is the gorgeous edition the libraries have.
Are any in the current editions available in bookstores that have these?
Often they have reprinted them, yeah. A lot of times, even in the cheap paperbacks, they'll reprint a few of the pictures. But you don't have at all the same feeling for it as I'm sure his own society had. And you know, in Victorian England, there wasn't a majority of people who could read. And very often the novels, people would sit around the fire like this and they would read to each other.
And the pictures were important, too.
I think Dover Press has come out with some reprints, and they're rather inexpensive. Yeah. I'll check on that.
This woman next to you on the set.
That's all right. It was just interesting to me that, like, just coming to the village, we just came in yesterday, and so this is our first day of sessions, although I've been here before, and I wanted to get in. I didn't know what all the talks are going to be, and that your topic is Dickens, but feasting. Because I don't think of the last year I thought too much about feasting, except that what shall I cook, you know, this type of thing. We were at a wedding 2 weeks ago. My husband's nephew got married, and they were giving toasts and so forth. And this is a Canadian wedding, which they have a feast after. It's very typical of to have a big dinner after the wedding ceremony. And they were toasting, and they just mentioned something about the young couple getting to know each other, because he would come over to her house and eat, and how this was such an important thing. On when you eat together, you are friends together, and very seldom do friends together eat together. And it just set up a whole new field of thought. And and is that Mary back up there? I can hear the voice, and she was talking earlier about the celebrations of Dickens, how this whole thing kind of goes follows together about celebrating together. You tend to eat together.
Well, I was always told I got my husband through his stomach. So.
Yeah.
The first weekend I was there, I made him chocolate cake and stuffed chocolate chip cookies for him, things like this, you know. But I mean, I think food is very important.
Well, you said that enemies don't often eat together, but friends eat together and become better friends through eating together and sharing their friendship and food.
Yeah. There are a number of meals that I haven't even gotten into this at all in this first little talk, but there are lots of occasions on which enemies do eat together in Dickens novels, and the awful things happen, you know. One thing, they get indigestion, usually. And, you know, people are kind of destroying each other at the dinner table, either through their wit, you know, or through insulting each other, or some way or another. Some real destructive things go on around the table, too.
I think the other interesting thing is that in our Lutheran heritage is the sharing of the communion of the sacrament together, which everybody likes to participate in. It's not just the priest or the one wedding couple or whatever. It's the whole congregation sharing together in the sacrament, which somehow goes along with it.
Yeah.
Well, the past 2 years now, our church, the Maundy Thursday communion dinner. Someone finishes the wine, somebody finishes the bread. This year, I make the bread. And for me, it was really a complete sharing with the whole entire congregation because it was my bread. And I really felt that this was a closeness I had never really shared with the whole congregation.
Did you make it unleavened?
No, I didn't make unleavened bread. The whole week.
There was a Vespers last week when the subject of feasting came up. Was anybody here then? Well, you were here then. And he talked about how that one of the important aspects of Jesus' type of feast was that everyone was invited. It wasn't an exclusive feast, as I was reading from the preface. It wasn't an exclusive dinner. It was a public repast. And this Fezziwig's Ball picture from a Christmas Carol, I can't find the place, but Fezziwig goes out in the highways and byways, and he invites everybody, and it's the same kind of thing. Let's see. In came the fiddler with a music book and went up to the lofty desk and made an orchestra of it, one vast, substantial smile. In came three Miss Fezziwigs, beaming and lovable. In came the six young followers whose hearts they broke. Three and six. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. In came the housemaid with her cousin, the baker. In came the cook with her brother's particular friend, the milkman. In came the boy from over the way who was suspected of not having board enough from his master, trying to hide himself behind the girl from next door who was proved to have her head or ears pulled by her mistress. In they all came, one after another, some shyly, some boldly, some gracefully, some awkwardly, some pushing, some pulling. In they all came, anyhow and everyhow.
His imagination and celebration really did come together in that preface that you were reading from, where he offers his feast to everybody, the whole public. And that's a beautiful connection with Leo's comment about Jesus' feast being offered to everyone. But it made me wonder, who were the everyone in Dickens' audience that would read this? You said the lower classes couldn't read?
A lot of them couldn't.
What were the groups of people that were included in his feast that he offered them?
Well, I think primarily middle-class people, although probably some upper-class people too. But there were mechanics institutes and different kinds of schools for working people that began to be set up as the century went on, where people did learn to read, and they learned basic science and all kinds of things, kind of self-education things. But there were a lot of the lower classes that couldn't have read Dickens, that's true.
Even the Sunday schools were actually reading schools for us. Oh. From about 1850 on, that movement around Kingsley and Maurice, you have more and more of the local schools for equipment to read.
There were just all kinds of people that he appealed to. And in his later life, he did public readings, and it was a very bad thing for his health, and he eventually was killed by them, really, because he overexerted himself, got overexcited, and had a stroke. But he would read from his novels, and these great big audiences would gather, and he just loved it. And it was really kind of strange, but, you know, there he was. His audience was right there in the flesh in front of him. And they laughed together, and they cried together, and so-and-so was carried out fainting, and he just loved this. And he wrote on one occasion, he said that they got everything, they understood it all perfectly, and we were laughing, and it was all as though we were going bodily up into the clouds together. What an image of shared liberation.
What were the years that he was writing his novel? Between what span of years?
Well, let's see. Pickwick, I'm trying to think what the years are, 1832 or something like that, through to about 65. My mind goes blank on what all the dates are. But the novels that I've been reading from are from the 40s and 50s and 60s. So, you know, the major novels are in the central part of the century.
Did he come to the U.S. to lecture?
Yes. He did several times, and he wrote about it in a travel book called American Notes, which was somewhat flattering. And he wrote it in a novel called Martin Chuzzlewit, which was not flattering at all. In fact, Americans were extremely incensed by the nerve of this Britisher to criticize their society, but he did anyway. And American Notes kind of made up for that. But he was quite successful and feasted himself over here. And, you know, he would go to dinners and people would be drinking toasts to him and just putting on the dog and all these lavish decorations and food and everything. He really, you know, wasn't a glutton himself. And he would have to go through all these toasts. And so he would have next to him a glass of toast and water. Isn't that odd? But it was something that apparently that people in that day drank or chewed on or whatever. And he would toast with the water, because if he toasted every toast with wine, he would get quite drunk indeed.
My condition is given as a
suggestion. I don't know, it sounds kind of watery to me.
I was thinking too about this gluttony. Masterpiece Theater, if anybody watched Upstairs Downstairs this past year, and Alistair Cook comment afterwards on the gluttony of Prince Edward. And there, I mean, the amount of food that was put on the table, they couldn't possibly eat more, like just a morsel of each piece, and the wastage that must have gone on with it. But when they'd have, say, five kinds of meat plus fish, and that was just one course, and then you'd have all these vegetable dishes and all the fruits, and then, like, for country breakfast, you would actually have three different tables full of food. We just can't imagine the gluttony that went on at that time.
Yeah, there are just such radical extremes, you know, between the orphans and the people in
the contrast and other people who are actually starving to death at London, say, in the early 1900s at the same time.
Well, I'm getting hungry.
Oh, my.
So why don't we break, and if you're interested in picking up any copies of the novel or of just the first four chapters, I'd be glad to give them to you. And we'll meet here tomorrow again at the same time if you want to come.
And let's eat with joy today.
Yeah.